Hey gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and this week I have two very special guests. I have Shelley Jones, she's an associate professor of English at SUNY, and Tanya Popita, PhD candidate in communication and culture at Ryerson in York. How are y'all doing?
Great.
Great.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's awesome to have y'all here. So the main thing I've brought y'all on to talk about is an article that you wrote. But first, so neither of you is in a department or a program that would be described as gaming, and yet you study gaming at an academic level. So could I maybe hear from each of y'all how that came to be?
Sure. Shelley, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I got my PhD in comparative literature from SUNY Binghamton. In which my dissertation was on the role of forgiveness in tragedies of Euripides, which is very far and away from what we're talking about currently. So I bounced around from a couple of different academic jobs, trying to get a tenure track job. And first was a visiting assistant professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, which At the time, I was still thinking that I really wanted to study classics and Euripides, and then kind of eventually realized I was done talking about Euripides and just didn't have anything useful to say about him or his plays anymore.
Traitor.
I know, I'm sorry. I still love him and I still enjoy teaching him in my mythology class. However, academically, I didn't have anything else to add to the conversation that I thought was useful or pertinent. So, I'm sorry about that. And I happen to be at Rochester Institute of Technology, which has I think they would, many of those students and professors would classify themselves as geeks and nerds. And I definitely felt at home there in many ways. While I was there, decided, oh, yeah, I can write about the things that I do for fun. So I can write about Dungeons and Dragons and playing board games, and why not? Honestly, being a visiting assistant professor there and not having that pressure of, oh, I have to produce something right now for a tenure necessarily, kind of gave me a couple of years of flexibility to try my hat at giving me that shift in time from studying classics to kind of exploring what game studies was and how to produce and how to publish things in that field. So that's, via classics is how this all came about.
That's a fantastic journey. What about you, Tanya?
Yeah, so I'm returning to school after about a 25-year career in life sciences, high tech. I started my career as a high tech reporter, writing for various computer publications, and met Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. And then I decided to go back to school after years and years away and take a PhD program in communication and culture. And initially, my dissertation topic was about workplace harassment and bullying and the use of interventions like AI and VR to kind of help people, practice difficult conversations, deal with bullying and harassment in the workplace, because it's an important issue. And there are laws on the books now in Ontario that really focus on how to prevent, harassment and bullying in the workplace. And then I realized I was looking specifically at augmented reality, VR, and AI as a kind of convergence of training, and realized that I really wanted to look more heavily at board gaming, because I started to realize with this renaissance in board gaming that board games were actually an amazing training and learning tool. And moreover, they actually did a lot of the things that, some of the interventions with VR and, computer-based interventions, they did it better. They taught systems thinking, they taught design literacy, some of the things that I really wanted to have people come away with. So I started looking at board games, and I actually was witnessing, we were obsessive collectors of board games. We spent most of our weeks pre-pandemic at board game stores because we love them so much. And I started to notice that there were some of the same earmarks in the community as I noticed in, you know, high-tech workplaces, sort of the politics around gatekeeping, harassment and bullying. And I started to think, you know, where is the scholarship in this space? And I actually was trying to find an answer to a question and I couldn't. And it was the question of like, who designs the top hobby board games and what's the demography of the design team? And I assumed it was out there. It wasn't. And I created a study and I approached the Analog Game Studies journal. Now both Shelley and I are editors at that journal. But at the time, I didn't know where the scholarship was or where the answers to some of those questions were. And I published it. And, you know, it definitely made a bit of a stir in the community in terms of looking at demography and was really one of the first efforts in that space. There were other terrific efforts, but there was a limited amount of scholarship around board games. And I thought that was wrong. So that's my journey into studying board games. And I actually completely upended my entire PhD dissertation and changed it to looking at racial and gender representation in the board gaming sector. And I'm on chapter 4 right now of my dissertation. Stay tuned.
Yes, congratulations. So the two of you have actually written an article together for Analog Game Studies. And the title is An Analysis of Gender Inclusive Language and Imagery in Top-Ranked Board Game Rulebooks. So do y'all want to give us a little overview of what that article is about? I mean, other than the title?
Sure, absolutely. So Shelley and I looked at 40 game rule books in the top Board Game Geek ranking. So it was the top 40 games. And it actually all started last year, the before times, July 2019, where I was noticing some interesting discussions happening on Board Game Geek, on some of the fora there. And I thought, you know, this is really interesting. It keeps cropping up as a topic of discussion and debate. And then I witnessed a bunch of Twitter exchanges about it. And I thought, why are we debating, you know, gendered pronouns in rule books at this, you know, late stage? And I remember, and I kind of, Shelley and I got to speaking on DM on Twitter about, you know, the fact that this kept cropping up as an issue. And I said something kind of flip about the fact that I had worked in the Department of National Defense, you know, years and years ago in the early 90s, actually. And, you know, I was not allowed as an editor of a military manuals to use gendered pronouns, to use male exclusive pronouns, because that was not the standard. And we had a terrific back and forth on it. And I said, let me take this away and I'll start looking at, you know, some of these rule books and do a bit of a systemic analysis to see what's happening in the rule books and see if there's anything there. And long story short, we kept working on it through, you know, it was actually originally planned for the May issue. And then the pandemic, of course, happened and we postponed. But it was a really, really interesting question that didn't seem, it was confusing to me why it wasn't settled science that you would be more inclusive in your language and imagery in this kind of material.
In terms of like the timeline, we had talked about this over a year ago. And honestly, it was just like Tanya said, we kept seeing these posts on various social media where, you know, women would be like, why when I open this rule book, do all I see are male pronouns? Or why when I open this rule book, it's just all male imagery. And so Tanya and I just decided that there was something here that we really needed to explore this more academically. And we've certainly seen, you know, there have been other outlets by game reviewers where they comment on it sometimes, or you know, and there's been a lot of grassroots efforts by different organizations to increase diversity and inclusivity in the hobby. So something like Tabletop Gamers or the Meeple Like Us, but not necessarily talking about, you know, what can the industry do? You know, it's often focused on incorporating diverse players and trying to build communities within the players, but not going back to the source and the origin necessarily to say, well, what can the industry do to be more inclusive? And such a simple thing as using inclusive pronouns in your rule books is it's not the only fix, it's not a panacea, but it is certainly one very easy step to be more inclusive.
And our top line findings were really surprising to me. It was another one of those situations where I had gone in with a much more optimistic viewpoint on what we were going to find. And what we discovered is in that 40, those top sort of cream of the crop games, these are the top most voted on and beloved games on Board Game Geek. And I was really surprised. One of the things I sort of joke about in the article is I created a rubric, just like a good teacher might, and I graded the rule books, all 744 pages of them, on some four criteria. So it was a possible ranking out of four. And what we discovered, and I mark very leniently, and I explain that in the article, that if there were one image of a feminine presenting woman or girl in the rule book, they would score a point in that category. If there were any reference to feminine presenting women or girls in terms of example players, they would get a point. And what I discovered was that that landscape of 40 top ranked games got a 70% average. And I was really surprised by that. Again, with that lenient marking scheme, that was the best. You know, if you think about that cream of the crop, that topmost ranking, these are the marquee games in the hobby board gaming category, as voted on by a million people. And that was the score overall. And what was surprising too was, you know, just some of the examples of, and we drill into some of the examples of how we graded, why we looked at things the way we did, what the categories were, and what the whole sort of market logic is, because Shelley raised such a good point that this is a delimitation for the board gaming sector. We talk about professional frameworks and processes and standards, and what we found was a really ad hoc, very scattered, very slapdash way of approaching some of the rule books. And we were very surprised by that. And so, you know, what we're arguing for is that there's a maturation needed in the sector. And there were some really wild swings among publishers even, who got, you know, the best possible score and also the worst possible score. So some real disparities and fluctuations even among the publishers themselves. So, you know, again, the sort of central thesis is, you know, the sector can do better than this. Other sectors are doing better than this. And we're basically making an argument for a better approach to writing rule books, because it is, it's a marketing, I'm a project manager as well. And I would look at risks, you know, facing a particular product launch or service and say, you know, you've got an issue in the way in which you address your market. And this is essentially, the essay is really to the board gaming sector to say, you need to professionalize, you need to create standards, and you need to welcome people in. And right now, you know, with this top tier, they're not doing that. And, you know, we speculate in the article that if we went deeper into the BGG listing, you know, what would we find if this is the cream of the crop?
It would probably be worse, undoubtedly. Right. And I would just to emphasize what Tanya's saying there, I really want to emphasize the fact of how lenient we were in the grading rubric. We've gotten some responses on this article about it. Folks are saying, oh, 70%, that's not that bad. Like, why are people complaining about that? And it's one, not less about complaining, but also it was only 70% because of just how very lenient of a grader Tanya was in this. So for example, she talked about the, if there were any imagery of, you know, a single woman in a rule book, that it got a point. And so that got it a better score. But that's even if the image was awful, right, or stereotypical or demeaning to the female imagery. So something like Food Chain Magnet, right, was a great example that Tanya kind of, we looked at in the article, where almost all the women in that are portrayed as waitresses. And of course, then the managers are portrayed as men. And some, you know, you might think, oh, thematically in the 50s, sure, whatever. But we even gave that, you know, a pass, so to speak, because it did have a feminine presenting image in it, even if that image was derogatory or demeaning or stereotypical in presentation. So there really was an extreme leniency in this with that. And then to go back to like the 70%, you know, I could see where somebody might think, oh, well, 70% is more than half. So what are they complaining about? But Tanya and I were both thinking of it in terms of grading, being the academics and the teachers that we are. We're like, 70%, that's barely passed, you know, like you're in the C minus range. Like, that's not great. That shouldn't be, you know, we would hope that they would be, you know, wanting to do better than below average in that score.
That's exactly right. And the only instance we found in Food Chain Magnet of a woman taking a position of leadership was a district manager. And literally the flavor text is, and fire that district manager, she's only costing us money. So it's an example of a game that got a, you know, a reasonable score, not a perfect score, but they reference, you know, female imagery, the pronouns. But in that case, that was a quite negative. And we don't really assess the negative or positive representation, of which, you know, frankly, some of the games that scored points did portray women in an overly sexualized and negative fashion. So, you know, we really wanted to establish, like, here's how this work could be done. Here's how we could make an assessment of these game rule books. And really the upshot is it's a signal of inclusion. And we use the analogy in the end of the article about, you know, kind of a goofy story that I used to hear a lot when I was younger about, you know, Van Halen, and they used to ask for all the brown M&Ms to be removed from their craft services table as they're about to take the stage and after in the post show. And people were like, oh, that's a ridiculous, you know, celebrity run amok kind of request. But the reason that they did it was to show that the venue was following contract guidelines. Because if you don't get the small things right, you won't get the big things right either. And what we're trying to say in the piece is, this is an industry that wants to bring more people into the tent, wants more people to board game. And if you don't get the small courtesies right, you might not be getting the big ones either. And it's a signal. It's a signal to a wider marketplace that you're either welcome or you're not. And the argument we're making is, and this is something that's really borne out in a lot of the research that Shelly included in the piece, that this is a marketing best practice. This is a brand best practice. This is a signal of maturation of an industry when you're able to bring more people in, create more conversations with people, and signal inclusion by getting those small courtesies right.
And why wouldn't an industry want that?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that is the truth. Is there research to indicate that these sorts of linguistic touches really do matter in terms of how people perceive their place in an industry? Because the most common complaint I hear is, why do you care so much? Everyone knows that he can just default to include anyone and just shut up and play your game and have a good time. Why shouldn't we shut up and just play our games?
Yeah, absolutely. There is definite science to support the idea, and Shelley's included that in the piece, that brands that use the direct address, the you and your family, it creates a feeling of closeness. And Shelley, speak to that more.
Yeah, there's definitely several articles, you know, in existing research, not specific to board games, that have talked about the use of the second person. So incorporating the you into different advertisements or marketing techniques, and that created a positive connection to the brand itself and having this kind of brand identity positively with that product that then made people feel more included in that community of folks who use that brand. And then just had a positive feeling associated with that brand. So then they were more likely to buy from that company again. So something as simple as changing rule books from he to talking about the player to just you. And some rule books have done that or start to do that. And then sometimes when they're talking about examples of, you know, when you're using an example of, oh, in this specific instance, when you, the player, are then playing with, you know, these other players, the things like that sometimes tend to drop just using the you pronoun. But yeah, it absolutely is impactful, and it absolutely does make a difference psychologically to the consumer. And that's regardless of, that's not even taking into consideration things like if you're a trans person, if you are a non-binary person, if you don't associate necessarily with the, with whatever pronoun somebody might assume that you quote unquote should be associated with. So definitely trying to, doing this kind of subtle thing of being more inclusive just through something as simple and something that we take for granted sometimes just as a pronoun can really make a difference.
And it's really interesting. Brendan Riley from the Pick Up and Deliver podcast, I was listening to his comments on the use of he as a default for humanity. And it was nice to hear a man speaking about the fact that when he was reading Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness, he realized that because she was using he in reference to the genderless race, he could only picture them as male. And it was very resonant to me because as a woman, reading content that says he and him feels very, it feels less than inclusive. And I do not read it in that same way. And it was interesting to hear a man in board gaming say, this bothers me too. And it was really, really good to read some of the threads where, some players are saying, why is this still happening, and asking for better from the sector. So it definitely kind of validated that we're not alone in thinking that this is an issue. And definitely hearing from a lot of other sources and just going through board game fora and seeing that this is a problem for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I would just hearken that again, it is not, we are not trying to say that this is a board game only issue. It is certainly an issue across many different media and industries. So for example, in the article, we reference other research that's been done about the use of pronouns and male-centric imagery or man-centric imagery in things like computer science brochures, trying to get students interested in a particular major, or in the textbooks of particular, often science-related textbooks or material. And that it becomes a barrier and a boundary for women students who are trying to gain entry and access into these different fields, because these materials just kind of default to the he pronoun for whatever reason, whether it's because there tends to be more masculine presenting students in the classroom, or there are more materials written by male authors or whatever. But it is definitely a phenomenon that happens across multiple sectors, multiple industries.
Another thing that struck me about y'all's work is, again, we talked about the leniency of the rubric. And so you can say, oh yeah, I guess a sizable chunk of games showed some inclusivity, but once again, that doesn't denote the tone taken towards women who are depicted or mentioned in those rule books. And the other thing that you started to hint at is that this study also does not account for representation of people of color, of people who are members of the LGBT community. We started with an article about male and female pronouns, but there is a long way to go in terms of tracking representation in the gaming industry. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. And there are so many dimensions that you could look at, like disability, like race. And, you know, based on having done this work, looking at these 40 rule books, I can tell you that if we did it on the measure of racial inclusion, it would definitely have received a failing grade. Yeah. So I think, you know, and that's where my dissertation is going very heavily into. I've doubled my database. I'm looking at 400 top board game geek games, and I'm looking for things like, you know, the demography of the designers, the, you know, demography and representation of the board game artwork. And the numbers aren't improving, unfortunately. Although I surmise that, or I hypothesize that from 2018 to now, there might have been some progress. And I'm not seeing that. And so I think the big call with this article is, you know, we really designed it for board game publishers. We really want to be in dialogue with people who produce games because we love and respect them. And we really want to make sure that they're thinking about these things because, again, it's about market delimitation. It's about market expansion and growth. If they want to do that, if they want to expand, they have to start addressing a much broader audience. And just as Shelley is saying, there is this idea of a stereotype threat. And it's this concept that if you consistently exclude a demographic segment from media, from reference in content, in articles, in textbooks, that demographic segment feels completely disappeared. And that can spill over into feelings of not being part of that particular sector. And that's actually one of the reasons why the Canadian government went very heavily into this in the 80s and 90s, because they did see and did map out a direct correlation with, for example, the aviation sector. If consistently the content was male, him, he, there was a direct correlation with women feeling like, that's not really for me. I shouldn't be in this sector. My identity's not even referenced in any of these materials. What am I doing here? And so language is really important. And Shelley has a terrific quote in the piece that I really like and I think about a lot. And it's, language is a system of power. It socially constructs that which has meaning and therefore has the potential to affirm or deny personhood. And that's Wendling. And Shelley's included that because the way that you construct everything, and designers know this, you're basically programming human behavior. You're telling someone, you know, this is when you do this. And this is and these are the values that I'm trying to, you know, reinforce throughout this game. And this is the message I'm trying to send. And here are the ideas I want to share with you. You're programming people with board games or any game. And so the choices, big and small, that you make in the design of that game have an impact on people and can have a knock-on, a ripple effect across communities. So being thoughtful, being value-driven, being inclusive in the way that you construct everything will resonate, and it will help people feel welcomed into this sector and space, which will only help it grow.
And I would just add to that, 2 years ago, what Tanya's first article with Analog Game Studies was specifically looking at and assessing gender and racial representation in the board game industry, looking at the images on the box cover art, looking at who the designers were themselves and their demographics. And that is our second most viewed article on Analog Game Studies, and not just because it was picked up by the New York Times a couple of times, but it's a topic that people are interested in. It's a topic that people, that there is this conversation starting around it. I mean, honestly, the top four or five articles most views on our site have to do something with representation. Right, have to do something with how misogyny and how the representation of the female body is in Dungeons and Dragons, how Dungeons and Dragons appropriated the Orient, representations of queer sexuality in Dungeons and Dragons. Like, there is definitely conversations that are being had, and people want to think about this topic and explore these representations and try to figure out, and then the next step is, of course, how to figure out how to fix it, right? Which is always the hang up, right? Always like, well, how do we make it better? And often what happens We've gotten many posts on our site saying like, oh, well, you just want to always point about the problem, but you know, you don't have any solutions for it or how to fix it. And quite frankly, like that's the industry has to do that. Like we are trying to like provide them the starting point of a conversation saying, we're noticing this isn't useful to you. Take that information and you are the creative content. You are the industries. You need to figure out what to do with this work that we've done for you, kind of, to try to make this more inclusive. We want to be playing games that I want to play a game where I don't have to be like, oh, yep, I guess I'll be the character who's the sexy warrior lady who's barely wearing any clothes. I guess that's, or I'll play the woman who's the cheerleader or whatever. Or I'll just play the dude character. There just often isn't, you know, what we want to see and what we want to play. Because Tanya and I love playing board games. We want to play board games, but we want to play board games that make us feel like the reasonably intelligent human beings that we are and see ourselves in those games.
Exactly. And, you know, with my dissertation research, I've recently conducted a fairly wide-ranging online survey. And I'm definitely seeing that the numbers of people who feel as we do, and that was something I was looking to get validated in terms of inclusion, representation, playable characters, artwork, who designs the game, it's really important to people. And, you know, the numbers are actually very, very starkly in favor of, I want to see my gender identity represented in games. Positive representation matters to me. And that is, it's correlated to a high, high level of agreement among the people that I polled. And it's interesting to see that validation, just as Shelley is saying, that this is not a niche problem. This is a widespread issue. And people are doing what, you know, Adrian Shaw, who's a personal hero of mine, said, sometimes it's about resigned apathy. Sometimes, you know, the lack of representation, and I used to feel this way too, when I was playing games in the 70s, 80s, 90s, I would think, well, I just want to play. I'm going to, you know, I'll accept the boob armor. I'll accept the kind of goofy cheerleader costume because I just want to play. And, you know, what are you going to do? You sort of throw up your hands and you have that feeling of resignation. Like, I like action movies. I don't always love what's in the action movies, but I'm just going to throw up my hands because it's what I have to work with. It's what the industry is giving me. And don't read my apathy or my, you know, resignation as acceptance. It's just, I got to do with what I have. I have to find myself somehow in this media, despite the fact that it's really not made for me. And sometimes it's aggressively, you know, trying to drive me away. And I think that's a really
death monster.
Yeah, exactly. And we do touch on Kingdom Death Monster later.
I think probably the spot in the article that Tanya and I thought, well, that's interesting, but didn't feel like would want to do a follow up on, because again, I think it's an observation that merits deeper consideration and more full-fledged consideration than simply the top 40 games on Board Game Geek. But that would be that the designer diversity really did affect the scores that the rulebooks got. So if your game was designed by a woman, they received a better score. And that's not because, you know, like we were cognizant of that. We were simply reading the games and then looked at the scores and then tallied them and realized, oh yeah, those actually do score better. So something like Elizabeth Hargrave's Wingspan scored perfectly. So whether that's because they're more aware of being more inclusive in their board games because they are women designers themselves, or something else is going on. I mean, Elizabeth Hargrave's Wingspan came out, you know, it was on the BGG list and was, had maybe just come out or hadn't been on there for very long, but, and more recent games did score overall, tended to score better. That wasn't 100% consistent, but in it was a hopeful trend, a positive hopeful trend that that it was becoming more apparent to include things like the they pronoun, or just being more gender inclusive in general the later the board games came out. But that is definitely an area that Tanya and I would like to look into more, and or that at the very least merits deeper look, an examination by someone, because it's an interesting find.
And it was actually something that Shelley prompted me to take a look at, you know, this, the notion that diverse teams make more, you know, more inclusive games, that question. And what we found was that if you had a game designed by a white woman, the average rulebook score for inclusivity out of 4 was 3.5. If it was designed by a BIPOC man, so a Black, Indigenous person of color, it got an average of 3.25 out of 4. And the aggregate, the remainder, were designed by white men, and the average score out of 4 was 2.8. So, and it's interesting, exactly as Shelley says, there is a hopeful trend line that things seem to be improving over time, not absolutely, but, you know, the average score for something that was produced in 2018 was around just a little over 3.5. And then there was an earlier game that was 1 out of 4. So I think, yeah, we definitely did see a sort of longitudinal improvement. And we really want to delve into that deeper. And that's something that in my dissertation I'm going to be doing, is looking at that notion of diverse teams being more thoughtful and more inclusive in the way that all of the elements of the game are constructed in terms of artwork and language. And hopefully we'll have a little more rich data set to pull from.
I have a question based on something you said earlier, Tanya, which is, I liked that you talked about games as programming, that designers create games in order to influence human behavior. People decide to follow a set of rules. They accept the world of the game. And do you think that even if you don't realize that you're programming something, that you are, that there's really no such thing as just a game?
Oh, 100%, 100%. And I really subscribe to Dr. Mary Flanagan, who is another personal hero of mine, created something called Grow a Game. And I actually ran one of my first workshops this fall with post-secondary students. And the idea is that Mary Flanagan talks about values in games. And she really speaks about the fact that whether you know it or not, even whether the designer knows it or not, games are imbued with values, ideology, political beliefs, assumptions, sweeps of, you know, assumptive logic that you may not even realize is there. And one of the things that, you know, she uses as an example, and I'm sure people have heard this many, many times, is Monopoly was originally designed by Lizzie McGee to kind of almost like in a sort of procedural rhetoric way, kind of make the point that taxation and monopoly property ownership was bad. And she was trying to make, it was almost a polemic or an essay about taxation and, you know, the fact that once you start losing in a capitalist and poor taxation system, you cannot win. But once you start winning, you cannot lose. And it was always meant to show you the kind of upsetting, distressing quality of just getting, you know, as you fall further and further behind, you cannot catch up, which anyone playing Monopoly knows. And so, you know, and that's why, you know, families, you know, burst into tears and people don't speak to each other after some of those games. But it's imbued with this idea. She wanted to create a feeling of discomfort that people could come away with and say, that's not fair. And that kernel of an idea, that original sort of operating system of that game, continues to this day. And even more sadly, from a meta perspective, that game was effectively stolen from her and taken over by Charles Darrow, who took it and made millions. She made exactly $500 from it. The point there being that every part of a game, your decision of, you know, game mechanic, your idea about the theme, the flavor text you include, all of that is imbued with what you know, the ideology you're steeped in. And therefore, you've got, you then bring that feeling, those ideas into somebody else. And, you know, playing some of those games over and over as children kind of we take up some of those ideas, those assumptions about, you know, what it is to earn money. When you play the game of life, as another simplistic example, you know, it privileges having lots of kids or, you know, doing certain things in your life, getting married. And as a child, you actually take some of those things up and think, that's success. This is what success looks like. This is what the world wants me to believe success is. And you bring that with you. And there's no, you know, even the game of life was was actually taken from an old game from the Church of England, where it was talking about virtues. Snakes and Ladders is a Hindu and Jainist morality tale. These games were created by church officials to kind of imbue certain notions of what is cleanliness, what is success, what is morality. And so games are used the world over as learning and educational tools to teach certain values. And you're essentially putting into the minds of the players, this is how you're going to act, this is the order in which you're going to act, these mechanics are privileged over other mechanics, and this is, you know, conquering is a greater value than compassion. You know, in the game of Risk, you're not going to win the game if you just decide to create a collective partnership and not kill anybody. So that's, yeah, that definitely Mary Flanagan stuff speak a lot to just the steeped in ideology aspect of gaming.
Both of y'all are also in linguistic and sort of communicative fields. So, you know, Tanya, you're in communication. Shelley, you are in comparative literature. Do y'all consider board games to be literature?
I would say absolutely, yes. I mean, it is as communicative as a film. And in fact, I feel sometimes that a game is even a deeper experience, because you're not only, you know, experiencing a narrative element if it's there in the game, or you're imbuing a narrative element. Someone made an argument, I actually argue this, that Go, you know, if you add a little bit to it, you know, it's very abstract, but if you add a sort of mental map in your head, you're a conquering general. You're carving off territory. You're creating, you know, you're in a war, right? Everyone brings, if you're like me, a narrative element to it. So it's basically making, just as a poem might convey a certain emotional feeling. And because you're programming the behaviors, the movements, there's a deeper artistic connection with a game player than might be possible. I'm sure this is controversial to many. Than, you know, a short film or a long film or a piece of music. It can be a deeper connection.
Well, I think because of the inherent agency within the task, right? So something is. Because you get to make those choices, right? Even if the choice is simply, am I going to sit down to play this game, right? And then proceed to enter into this, essentially this contract with the other player or the other players that says, yes, I am going to sit down. We are going to trust each other. I trust that you are not going to cheat. I trust that we are all going to abide by the rule set that has been laid down before us, and that we are going to, you know, commence with whatever actions are before us until there is a winner or we all win if we're playing a co-op or something. But yeah, absolutely. They are absolutely a kind, certainly if not necessarily literature, a form of media, right? And actually Paul Booth is his book, he has a forthcoming book published coming out in January. That's the title, quite simply, is Board Games as Media, right? And he's going to be analyzing, you know, in the different ways in which they function as a type of media to be consumed and to be analyzed. The only reason that's on the tip of my tongue is because I pre-ordered it and then found out that my husband had already pre-ordered it for me as a Christmas present. So we had to forgo with one of those pre-orders. Sorry, Paul, you're not getting two copies. But anyways, they absolutely are.
So where do y'all see your research going in the future? Do you plan to keep working together? What are some areas where work is needed in the field of analog game studies?
Well, Tanya has to finish her dissertation, so that way she can go off and become whatever world famous thing that she wants to do.
Yeah, this dissertation is right now, it's a beast. It is huge. And, it, you know, one of the things I was really gratified by is the number of people I heard from after the first study, which I had just done as a bit of a, you know, trying to solve or find an answer to a question that I couldn't find the answer to. So it was really just a quick, what I thought was going to be a quick little sort of sojourn into demography, because, you know, it had been done in so many other sectors. There was a 1979 or 1971 article about why were there no great women artists. And it's kind of a seminal piece in feminist writing. And it talks about all the different, you know, disparities and systemic issues and, you know, lack of visibility. And I thought, you know, I want to do the same thing for board games. And I did a small study. And one of the things that I learned was just this whoosh of people asking additional questions. And so I pick up some of those questions that I got in Twitter DMs and like on comment boards and in fora that I really wanted to get answered. And one is, you know, again, doing a much larger and more robust study of what is the world of game design from a demographic perspective, you know, who designs games right now, looking at artwork again, but in a larger sample size. And also looking at, you know, how representation matters or doesn't to the board gaming community. And, you know, what's fascinating about it is I wanted to layer on a qualitative perspective from actual, what it classifiably, when you look at the research, which hopefully some you guys will see soon, you know, once it's accepted through peer review, is that it does matter to the audience. It really matters. And it's people who are really dedicated board gaming enthusiasts who are saying, you know, yes, it does matter to me, but I resign myself. And there was actually one comment in the survey where someone said, if I sat down, thought about it, I'd be mad all the time. But I have to accept what it is right now, because I want to engage, I want to play. And if, you know, a game was designed by a BIPOC person or a woman or a trans person, they'd be more likely to buy that game, which is also very, very interesting. So, you know, it's, I think, a real opportunity. And my focus, again, my past history was really in like marketing, PR, and kind of the science of it. And I used to advise, you know, startups and large Fortune 100 companies about what you need to do to broaden your scope, to broaden your audience. And, you know, I'm just wanting to take this into a sector that I care passionately about and say, you've got to look at this. This is something that is actually causing you active harm in terms of the growth of your space.
And I would, yeah. Sorry, Tanya.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to add to that, that, you know, it is not just the case that we are saying, oh, if you make these changes, you will be adding women gamers and trans gamers to your table. You probably likely will, but that is not the only gamers that you will be adding. Like, this is not just a women's issue, quote unquote, or something like that, to use such an archaic terminology. It is not just the case that this is an issue that women gamers are concerned with, right? That's not what we're saying here. So for example, this summer with the Black Lives Matter movement, there were, well, one, you know, various things, various conferences, conventions didn't happen, and some got more shade and flack for various lack of addressing concerns. But when, you know, when different publishers and conventions came out or didn't come out with Black Lives Matter statements, that really made a difference. And that made a difference to consumers thinking about whether this is an organization and a company that I want to give my money to and whether other people want to give their monies to. So for example, this summer when a certain company came out with a very robust and positive Black Lives Matter statement, my husband went right out and bought a board game from that company, from our local board game store, and he just went to the store with the intent of, I am buying a board game from this company. They are good. I want to support them. I want to support my local board game store as well. But he wanted to make sure that, you know, that got recognized in some way, right? And that's, you know, because representation does matter, because decency and humanity does matter. And if there are companies and organizations that are putting humans first and putting that kind of compassion and that dedication to diversity first, the actions follow afterwards.
Absolutely right. And I definitely can tell you that, you know, friends and family did the same thing this summer, that when we saw a publisher or a game designer come out and make those kinds of statements, you know, I did the same thing. I rushed out and bought a bunch of games because I really want to see that. And that is something that, you know, a lot of corporations are really looking at, you know, in terms of corporate social responsibility, whether or not it's lip service or not. But people want to buy from organizations that do good.
Yeah. And you can tell from those statements which were lip service and which were like the bare minimum of we feel obligated to make this statement versus ones that actually gave a darn.
Yep, absolutely right. And that's a sign of this industry, you know, starting to realize that it is not a niche. It needs to appeal to everyone. It needs to have, you know, corporate social responsibility. It needs to have hiring best practices. And we really land in the piece on the idea that you absolutely must, you know, hire and bring on diverse talent and ask for a review of your content and pay those people that you're getting to review your content with a diverse perspective, pay them well to look at your game, to look at your practices, because I think that's how the industry professionalizes. That's how the industry expands. And, you know, just to land on, you know, a point that it, from a, just a numeric perspective, because I think that's something that really, you know, appeals certainly to gamers who have a little bit of that focus, you know, wanting to look at the final scoreboard. You know, it's fascinating to me. I literally counted every he and she in every single rule book. It was very hard. And I couldn't set up a natural language processing tool to do it because I wanted to make sure I wasn't missing the way the actual rule book is laid out. Because for all I knew, I was, you know, harvesting the he's from a personal letter that the designer had included or something. Or there was some narrative in there with a ton of he's. But this is in reference to players. You know, the word she appears 392 times across all of the rule books we looked at, and appears 1,107 times for he. So, you know, 73.8% he, reference to he as the player, and 26.2% is she in reference to the player. And so that kind of sort of, we used to call it in PR the thud factor, where you come into a client and you'd say, okay, here's what the numbers are telling us. It's almost like looking at a, you know, revenue chart or growth chart. How do we feel about that? And I think that the takeaway I'm hoping people take from the article is, you know, here's the thud. Here's the final number. Are we okay with that? Is that okay? And arguably, I would strongly suggest, no, we should not be okay with that. And Shelley raises a great point that it's not a one and done. It's not if you fix this one element of your rulebook creation process that things are suddenly going to work out better, because that's not it. That's not enough. And we cannot make that point enough in the article that it's not a switch you can flip, but it's about a mindfulness, a thoughtfulness. It can't just be a sort of papered over lip service checkbox kind of approach. It has to be an intention. And very similarly, Liz, to your really great question about programming, it's about the intention. It's about the overall intention, what you're trying to make people feel. And if you're trying to make them feel included, what do you do in all the different aspects? And you're not just programming for your game. You're programming for an industry, especially if you're a leader. You have to think about every little thing you do and really build in inclusion, diversity, equity into every step you take, whether it's writing the rule book, marketing your product, you know, from the initial conception of that product, design all the way through. You have to have that lens.
That is really beautifully put. So I'll ask y'all one lightweight question towards the end here. What is a game that each of y'all are enjoying right now, even in the midst of 2020 as it comes to an end?
Thanks to your extremely good recommendation, Liz Davidson. We watched your Too Many Bones, all of it, twice. We've been playing Too Many Bones. And although I did play as Boomer, and I had a little bit of a Boomer-like meltdown, so my partner's a bit scared to play with me now. I was not entirely certain how my various grenades worked. And I got a little sad at one point during the game. And he's like, "You don't like playing this character, do you?" It's just because I didn't know. But Too Many Bones is definitely a fantastic game.
Yes. What about you, Shelley?
Last week, my husband and I went to our local board game store buying last-minute Christmas presents and ended up buying about 4 games for ourselves in the process. But we didn't go to Gen Con this year, so, you know, we have, you know, it's fine. And we, 2 things that we brought home were Quacks of Quedlinburg, which I had thought, oh, no, he had played it on Tabletop Simulator with friends over the summer, and he kept telling me about it, and I was like, I don't really like Push Your Luck. I love it. It helped that as soon as we played, I handily beat him, but it was just loads of fun. And then we also brought home Reiner Knizia's My City, because it's kind of a legacy style game where you're building out a city, and I'm just such a sucker for world building kind of thing. So that's been a lot of fun. I wish on the cover it didn't say manifest your destiny, which is a little, it must not be as touchy of a phrase maybe in Europe as it is here, but maybe the American publisher would recognize that maybe that's not what we want to be, whatever. It has a lot of connotations, right, that we just don't want to be, I don't want to think about it. I might end up just putting a sticker over that. Maybe I'll put in, or we've also been playing a lot of, Abandon All Artichokes, which is loads of fun. And our copy came with a sticker. Maybe I'll put the artichoke sticker over the Manifest Destiny on the box.
That's adorable. And if we have further questions for you about your brilliant article, where can you be found online?
So I'm on Twitter at Pobita and Tanya, all one squashed together word. So my first name and my last name, and Pobuda is spelled P-O-B-U-D-A. And my first name is Tanya, T-A-N-Y-A, and it's sort of at Pobuda Tanya.
And I'm also on Twitter with the handle at Shelley Jansen, which was my maiden name, which is J-A-N-S-E-N.
Fantastic. And I'm everywhere on the internet as Beyond Solitaire. So thank you so much for listening, everyone, and happy gaming.